In the Fireside Room this evening, we are having Mr. Tom Holsinger Fuchs speaking on how come I keep getting into conflict with the same kind of people. Let's listen in.
Three or five. I'm going to do the 5-minute review.
Six.
6 minutes?
Five people.
I'm Tom Fuchs. I've worked at the Conflict Resolution Center at the University of North Dakota for about 3.5 years. Just left that, took a new job. So I'm in transition, but I do training. I'm still an independent consultant and a mediator facilitator. I work now really across the nation doing facilitation and mediation for a variety of different groups, including the United States Postal Service. I'm a certified mediator for those folks in their EEO program, Equal Employment Opportunities. We're gonna kind of catch you up really quickly. The idea that we're going to talk about and what this is all based on is that we believe every single person has a zone of kind of the ability to handle some conflict and some peace, okay? And it's, we build it on a continuum, okay? And the idea is that every person, children, adults, juveniles, high schoolers, we all have this zone that we try to live in. And for the most part, we can maintain it. And as I've watched Jillian, my daughter who's up there, try to develop this sort of stability, you know, this ability to handle some conflict and not start to cry. Because as we know, emotions and conflict are very closely related. And for really what I believe to be, certainly 40, 50 years, maybe more like 100 or so years, we've really sort of depressed and suppressed our emotional component of conflict, believing that everything can be solved if we stop crying, if we get control, and it's a natural part of our responses. We want to stay in control. That control zone, we call it a homeostasis. Yesterday, I think it was Barb didn't like it. What word did you like, Barb?
Comfort zone.
You can call it comfort zone. We call it a homeostasis because there's comfort zone for some people means that it's always comfortable. Okay. And one of the things that somebody else talked to me about is that in order to expand your homeostasis, your ability to manage conflict, you have to have conflict. Okay? The stability, the staying in this zone is a positive and a powerful place to be, but true change happens when somebody rocks our boat. Make sense? When somebody kind of tweaks us or challenges us to grow or to change, or we have some kind of event that pushes us out of this, we can actually establish and reestablish and come back into a place where we are more centered. Okay? You might want to call this your center. Call it whatever you like. We tend to use homeostasis. And we believe that when people come out of their homeostasis, when they drop out, John Gottman uses the word flooded. When you get emotionally flooded, our ability to manage anything at that moment is very, very confusing. And you never can find the right words in conflict, okay? In serious conflict, we always feel a lack. We feel pretty weak to be able to come up with those great words. I had a great conflict at Burger King a while ago. It seems like I always have conflict out in public areas, doesn't it? I went into Burger King. We had had a really tough weekend at my parents' house, and I wasn't paying attention to what was going on with me. And we went to Burger King on our way back between Crookston, Minnesota, and Painesville, where my parents lived. We were traveling actually home. got to Burger King, got our order, and I ordered a chicken sandwich, grilled chicken, no mayonnaise. They came through and I said, can I have some barbecue sauce for my chicken? She said, no. I'm like, what? She said, no, you're gonna have to pay for it. You know, and this is the moment when you wish, like 6 months later, I thought, what if I could have come up with the words, whatever happened to have it your way, huh? But you don't, right? I mean, I'm fumbling for words. I'm like, what? She's like, no, you got, I said, whatever. I said, okay, how much is it? She said, no, you gotta get back in line. I'm standing there. You know how it is? I'm just, now that shouldn't have pushed me out, okay? That shouldn't have triggered me, you know? But I instantly become the terrorist, okay? I'm powerless to make any real change in that organization. So I walk over to the ketchup machine, which is about from me to Bob away from her, and I turn sideways, and I just pump it right into the bottom tray. I get you, you know? Now that's a really juvenile thing to do, okay? But you know what? She was powerless to do anything about that. And I wanted her to feel how problematic that was for me. Now she probably didn't have to clean it up, and I don't really care. And it was a really a stupid thing to do. In fact, I talked about it with my girls later. It's like, that's not what I'm trying to teach my kids, okay? But what the problem was that I wasn't paying any attention to what was going on in my life. I was riding down on this edge. I was running on empty. You know what I'm talking about. And this was just the straw that broke the camel's back. You know, I was not articulate. I'd lost my words. And so we're going to continue to talk about homeostasis, our comfort zone. And within this homeostasis, we have all those good value words like caring, loving, kind, you know, wonderful parent, adorable. What were the other ones we came up with?
Irreplaceable.
Irreplaceable, that's right. Irreplaceable. All of those words that we sort of live by. And look at Holden Village. Holden Village encourages us to do these things. It encourages us to be community-minded, peaceful, nonviolent, spiritual, all of those centered things that we try and try and try. And why we come back here is to sort of experience it once again. Does this make sense for the people who weren't here yesterday? Okay, and when we look at how people are in conflict and we ask them, what does it feel like? They come up with words like, I felt frustrated, confused, sad. I felt a flushing of my head, like I couldn't come up with the right words. Some people even come up, I felt like I lost my religion. Isn't that a great term? If you think about it, losing your religion is all about losing your values, okay? And when we talk about the experience of the other person, how do you experience the other person? The other person is ignorant, what do we come up with, bitch, jerk, prick. You know, they are bad and mean, okay? And it never changes, okay? We get into conflict with each other, even people we love, and we immediately go there. And yet, we don't walk down the street and say, you know, this is my wife, she's an ignorant, mean. We don't. We don't use those words. It's only experience of conflict that makes us go there. Does that make sense? It makes us go to the place where we don't want to do. And we go there, what we do is we come out of our values. We lose our centeredness. Centeredness, we lose our comfort zone, we lose our, and we go to that place that we, and then we have to recover. We have to recover, and what we call it, Creedence Clearwater Revival. No, we call it Critical Conflict Replay. Every single person that we talk to replays conflict over and over and over again. And as you replay the conflict, doesn't matter the difference whether you're Sam or Malena or Jillian or you or I or Bob, all of us, When we get into conflict, we resolve the conflict in our heads, okay? And good conflict resolution, good resolving things happens mostly in our head. And oftentimes, it never happens with the lady at Burger King, okay? And it's not a pretty thing, because sometimes we lie to ourselves. Sometimes we make up dialogue about whatever happened to have it your way. Or, you know, if I only would have said that, I would have got him, you know? Or, you know, we do this as a process of moving back in. Critical conflict replay is a natural and a necessary part of our experience of conflict. And it happens to us. So, are you with me so far? People, new people who were here yesterday are all going like, yeah, let's move on, right? Let's move on to this. Okay, today we're going to talk about how come we get into conflict with the same kind of people. Do you agree with that? That you tend to sort of, I feel like sometimes I'm a bulb for like freaks, you know? Moths just fly at me sometimes. You know, or I feel like I have, and I think we all have, certain core identities that affect us. And so when I get into conflict, I can generally identify why I'm in the conflict. And it's taken me a while. This comes from a book called Difficult Conversations. I'm actually going to have you work in groups in just a second, because I'm going to have you kind of talk about this. What we're talking about now is triggers. Okay? What are the triggers that affect your homeostasis? Okay, what are the little things that sort of pull you down? I experienced one just before dinner. A former staff people, I'm hanging out with some of the other former staff people that I'm with, and we were trying to figure out how to get dinner up to our chalet so we wouldn't have to sit. And we know, because we wanted to talk and yak. And it was like, we knew that it happens, and we know that there's ways of doing it, but we weren't quite sure about how to go about doing it. Does that make sense? And one of the core competencies is autonomy. As I told everybody yesterday, I can't spell autonomy. Autonomy. If someone is pushing my buttons, generally I can take it back to somebody's telling me to do something. Like if someone's saying, go get me a cup of coffee, you know, do this right now. You know, have you ever got into those situations? Where's Mary Lou? Mary Lou, we were talking this afternoon about bosses and authority. Oftentimes, I can find myself in those kind of conflicts because it affects my autonomy, my ability to act independently and to be asked rather than told. How many people can recognize their autonomy triggers? Okay, so you're kind of connecting with those ideas. Another one is belonging. And belonging is a strange one. It's sort of like, how are you part of the group? And if someone is questioning whether or not you're part of an inner circle or a group, or they're excluding you, okay, then you immediately become triggered. You tend to sort of get pulled out. Does that make sense? There's always inner and outer circles and organizations. There's in churches, there's always the people who make decisions. Holden Village is a great example. There's long-term staff, there's short-term staff, there's guests. And this week, there's work camp people, and there's still long-term people. And now there, you know, you see that? You know, and it's all about how do we fit within this organization. And it's not overly, it's not like it triggers all of us, but there are certain moments when you sort of recognize that as much as everyone's trying to make us all be there's still people who have to make decisions, and we get permission, and there's tools, and there's, I mean, and it's a needed part of it, but it connects with belonging. Love. Okay. Love is a strong one because we want to be loved. I mean, at our very most important core, we want to be cared for. We want to be caring people. And so when we all of a sudden feel as though we're not being loved, or someone's questioning whether or not we're lovable, we have a real issue with it. The last one is competency. Competency is about your ability to do whatever you do. Parent. Okay? Has anybody ever questioned your parenting ability? You'll get triggered. Boom. Right, Emily? your ability to be a worker. Your ability to be a chainsaw operator. That's what I've been doing this week. And it's constantly a question about competency. And we've had to kind of go through this issue about, are people, you know, good enough to do these sorts of jobs? And, you know, we don't want to get in over our head. And competency is a trigger. So if somebody questions you, you know, how dare you do this in a workplace, oftentimes it's about competencies. So these are four very core components of this identity, this homeostasis. And here's what I'd like you to do. I'd like you to get together in groups of two or three, maybe four, and I want you to sort of list off what are some triggers for you. What are some things that just sort of bump you down, okay? And I'm talking about situations. I'll give you an example. The job that I just left, there was one of the administrative assistants worked from 9 to 5. That was her hours. And the work that I did worked from sometimes 9 to 5, sometimes 1 to 7, sometimes 3 to 9. I mean, it was varied hours, and sometimes we'd be gone for 3 or 4 days. But the moment that I didn't show up exactly when I was supposed to, she left a late slip on my desk, the administrative assistant. And it absolutely sent me through the roof, okay? And here's what it was about for me. It was about my autonomy. It's A-U-T-O, autonomy. Thank you. I finally got it, I think. Or closer, right? So does that make sense? So it was sort of like, and it just kept bugging me, okay? And we'll talk about how I came to resolve that after we talk about it. So what is it in your workplace, in your church, and in your environments, wherever you're at, that really sort of get your goat, okay? That's all I want you to do. And I'm going to send out, I have some markers here, and I'm going to grab some paper. I just want you to sort of make some lists, okay? Actually, I'll go in the recording studio and ask them if they have some pencils. Does that make sense, what I want you to do? Get into groups of 3 and 4. What are your triggers? What kind of pulls you out of your zone? Go ahead. I'll get some. I'll be right back. I could see that coming. Let's talk about, let's have somebody give us one trigger from one of the groups. Up in the corner, Lauren and Linda, what's one trigger you identified?
Pardon me?
What's a trigger you identified?
The competency thing. If I feel that someone criticizes my capabilities as a teacher or a parent, that really hurts.
Yep.
Yeah, and I feel a combination of hurt and anger.
Right, and immediately you're sort of on the defensive, right? Yeah, good. Right, and so that's good that you can connect it. Because the important thing, and remember we talked about it in the first session, none of the ideas that we're talking about really are new. What we hope that they do is that they fit your life's experience. and that you now can use a language to talk about it. Because I believe that one of the things that really holds us back as a church, as a society, is our inability to process what's happening to us in conflict. Okay? We talk a lot about peace. You know, we sing a lot about peace. But how often do we really talk about how do we really work to maintain our own centeredness? I mean, Milena has already fallen asleep. She's that peaceful. Look at this. I mean, it really works. Now, yeah, isn't that great? But, you know, think about this. That we really, we talk about it. You know, we give the sign of peace. But do we really go back? And how hard is that to really work on the true elements of peace? So good. Anytime that they question your teaching ability. What's another trigger? Up here, Emily?
Oh, we both had one around feeling like we've been manipulated to produce a result. They're saying it's yours, but they clearly know what they...
Like you're feeling handled.
Right.
Managed. Yeah, or managed. Which one of those competencies does it affect? Is it your autonomy or is it your competency?
Like sort of both.
Both?
Probably more autonomy though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Autonomy seems to be such a strong kind of connection for most of us. We wanna be, you know, I'm the boss of me. That's what I think about. I'm the boss of me. Don't we do that as 2-year-olds? Wanna say that? Milena just went through that. I can do that. No. Another one? Trigger over here, you guys?
What they said was when I feel like someone's trying to box me in or stifle my creativity, kind of order who I am.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yep, they're trying to fit you in the box, and they want you to sit right there, and they don't want you to move. Yeah. Which of the core identities are connected to that?
Autonomy.
It's autonomy. Yeah, over and over again, autonomy comes up. Good. This group back here, do you have one?
Being patronized.
Mm-hmm. Patronizing is it's a huge trigger for us. And the minute it starts, we sort of kind of right at that moment, yeah, we kind of pull ourselves. To, you know, it's like we get on defensive.
And that would be a combination of competency and autonomy, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This group? Yeah.
Misuse of questions, either repeated questioning or answering a question with a question.
And which one does it affect, do you think? I didn't want to ask you a question because I'd be guilty. Jeez, how'd you get out of that one? My core competencies.
I don't know.
So is it the rhetorical questioning?
I probably too many questions or else.
Too many questions?
Too many questions going both ways.
Yeah. Adults, particularly adults, never want to be made a fool of, okay? We don't want to be embarrassed. We don't want to be put on the spot. And it's a trigger for me, too, when someone asks a question is looking for a specific answer in a group, and you always feel like, I don't know if I can answer, because if I don't get the question right, is that the kind of feeling you're talking about? That in a larger group situation?
No, not particularly. Between two people. More.
Between two people.
Mm-hmm.
Photo op.
Hello.
J.C. Penney's.
You got a good look today.
There, thank you very much. Okay, I'm not sure I got that one, but we're gonna move on. Well, let's stick with it. So you're saying when someone questions or asks you questions because they're trying to get the answer from you?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Sounds like autonomy.
Autonomy.
There's probably an element of evasiveness in there.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Answering a question with a question.
Mm-hmm. Right. Because they may not know the answer, or they may also. You know,
or maybe they're looking for a specific answer.
Yes.
Keep asking a question until I get the right answer.
Yeah, absolutely. And to get what they want to hear, absolutely. Another one over here? Yes.
Our group kept mentioning discourteous behavior people.
Yeah. And what is it about discourteous behavior? Because it tends to come up quite a bit. Give me one specific example of discourteous behavior.
How about over here in the newspaper area, the magazines, and it's a quiet area, and you're sitting there and a couple of folks come in and start talking, and you go there to have some quiet time and read, and they go there, come in there, they could do it outside, they come in here and do it right in here. So really they're being, it's autonomy, I guess, would be my choice.
Because you'd like people to sort of follow a general policy or a general rule about how they should sort of live, or if there's a sort of a norm set up that everyone should sort of try and follow it. Yeah. Yes.
If somebody, either a friend or coworker, right, or a manager says, I want to talk to you, or we need to talk.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
I think that would fall under competency and belonging, depending upon who's saying it.
Yes. Probably and autonomy, because they're sort of saying, hey, you, get in here.
Yeah.
You know, and we are very much, and we so quickly respond to it. It's been interesting as I've done this exercise with people, that autonomy over and over again seems to be a strong pull for most adults. I mean, we sort of believe that we should be able to run our own lives, and if somebody is putting pressure on us to do something their way,
it's the 2-year-oldness, we want to do it our way.
Yeah. It is the 2-year-oldness, yeah. And you know where I see it all strongly is in churches. You know, mm-hmm. if you do something different in a church, yes.
There could be some things that you're doing that you're competent and you're trained at, and a person may want you to do it another way. And it's like that you know is totally wrong, and that flies in the face of competency right there.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't work that way.
Right, and then do you go back to that person who has more authority than you to argue it, or do you just keep your head down and go for it? See, that's where the conflict lies. And what is strange about it is, and it's a great example of a trigger, is that even if you keep your head down and do your job and don't say a word about it, you still carry that anger with you.
When if you do it their way, sometimes it goes wrong.
Yes.
And then you're held responsible for doing something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
And
these core competencies work against each other. Okay. Go ahead. You going to raise your hand?
I was just going to add another one.
Yeah.
People not following through with their responsibilities.
Mm-hmm. That they've promised to do, that they've made promises, and then all of a sudden it's like you're left holding the bag, as it were. Which one of those core competencies or core identities does it affect?
Not being able to see that far, the ones that are stuck in my head are gorgeous.
I'm sorry.
Autonomy, belonging, love, and competency.
Yes.
Competency.
Probably.
You've got more than your share of work to do, and you can't do it as well as you would if you were just doing your own job. Or maybe love, if it's a couple.
Someone you care about, you know, that you've asked to do something. Love is a strong one. Love is one of those ones that our children can trigger us all the time through misbehavior, you know. And it's like, you know, and I know that certainly my girls are at that stage now where it's like, I hate you. You know, that's sort of an intentional trigger, isn't it? I mean, they're trying to sort of shake up myself or their mom. Right, Jillian?
Fifth Amendment.
Fifth Amendment. She pleads the fifth. So we use these things over and over again. And the belonging and love are the ones that really stick to us in terms of our families. But what was the one you just gave the example of?
People not following through with their responsibilities.
Right, people not following through. That whole idea of competency. And the idea that we're talking about with this whole program is not about you not having any more conflict. Okay, it's really not about it. But the important thing for me has begun to recognize what's triggering me. Okay, let's talk about what's happening in churches. Okay, what kind of conflicts triggers happened in churches? Yes.
We had one. If the leadership delegates some task to you and then without telling you acts to counteract your work.
Micromanagement, through micromanagement or through just absolute.
Or lack of communication.
Lack of communication, right. And what's weird is that, and the work I do with churches is that this is where our values come together, okay? I just worked with a church where the whole church has gone through a huge amount of change. They got some video screens and some PowerPoint, and they're doing worship differently. And they had an annual meeting, and they were, this church happens to have 5 congregational meetings a year. 5. And they're like, as part of this whole change process, they said, we're gonna have a vote at the congregational meeting, and we'd like to just have one meeting. And people showed up, and the place just erupted. It was wild. I mean, it was like everything was bad. It was just like. And what happened to the leadership team was that they had an absolutely fundamental experience of conflict. I mean, they were just blown out of the water, and they kept reliving this conflict over and over again. And what they didn't recognize was that they had affected their belonging needs of all the people in the congregation and the competency. What is wrong with the way we've always done services? They haven't done a good job of answering those needs. Not that it wasn't a good conversation for them to have, but then how did they manage that experience once they've had it? In other words, empowerment and recognition. And I know that I've talked a little bit about that, but that empowerment and recognition, empowerment meaning clarity for yourself and what's going on, and recognition of the other person. Because in the beginning, and I worked with this group on like a week after this big congregational meeting, and one gentleman, I'll never forget him, he said, "That's not the way Christians should act." You know? Isn't that telling? Because we have this identity tied up about our values, you know, and he wanted to make all the people who voted down, and they voted it down, they're still having 5 congregational meetings a year, you know, because he, rather than, and we have to have clarity about what was going on for ourselves first. He hadn't played it through enough times. And in fact, when I started working with the leadership of this church, they got really sort of irate. And one woman started crying. I mean, she honestly started weeping about the situation. And it is very real. It is very real. But you can't go in and say, well, recognize these people's issues. You got to begin to listen. And that's what I do as a trainer, as a facilitator in conflict, is that I don't solve anybody's problems. I sit and I listen and I keep asking them good questions. I help them get clear. Because for us to do recognition, first we have to have empowerment. First we have to be clear about what the heck is going on. You got a question?
About the crying thing. I've not seen this happen before. Some women cry because it gets them a response. Uh-huh. And it gives them a certain amount of control too. Instead of dealing with an issue, they lose, you know, they lose their emotions, and it gives them a certain amount of control over things. And the thing is that I've learned this from my sisters. I have 6 of them.
And it feels manipulative. Is that what you're saying? It sometimes feels manipulative.
But the thing is, if you learn how to deal with it, it's like without offending them, and it's like.
And this, I'll come right to you, Lo. This is the only difference that they've been able to find out. The way men and women handle conflict has to do with this flooding. Okay. Men biologically respond differently to conflict than women do. Men hate coming out of their homeostasis, hate getting flooded. Okay? It's a very abrupt line for men. And once they're out, it takes them longer to recover than women. Women have a much softer sort of flooding line and can recover much easier. And they think that it's biological, having to do with that women had to nurture and nurse children, keep children quiet, and men had to defend home and hearth. They had to be powerful. And not only that, but once men get riled up and then resolve, or sort of at least from their amygdala come back, they can get reinvigorated much better than women and much faster than women do. Okay? And that's scientifically tested out. It's quite interesting. But yes, women and men respond to this, which is why the most scary thing that my wife can say to me is, "Tom, we gotta talk." Anything but that. Because I know we're up for 3 hours now, or you know what I mean? You guys, you understand that? You connect with that? That's a scary part for men. Because we don't want to have any tweaking of our little experience. That is a little harder edge for us. Makes sense? Bob, do you agree with that?
Yeah.
As soon as I wake up. Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Well, in terms of the research that's been done on rats, last time you talked about the fight or flight instinct. Mm-hmm. That research was done on male rats quite a long time ago. And a couple of years ago, I read that somebody had finally decided, hey, we could probably do this research on female rats. And so the person who was doing this research coined a new little rhyme for what happened with the females, which was, tend and befriend the females. Now, of course, this is a situation where they're threatened by some real force. The females tended to tend the young and get together with the other females in groups. Now, I like to think that as human beings, we're a lot more adaptable
than
in
rats.
Terms of sex roles or whatever, yeah, than rats. But I think that whether we are male or female, we can incorporate, depending upon the situation, those different styles, especially since a lot of the things that get us going are not physical threats, but emotional perceived threats, but not threats.
Not real life-threatening threats.
And I also think that while it's true that I have known women who cry to be manipulative or get power, there are also plenty of times when I have been so angry that I started to cry and then could have kicked myself because I'm losing control and have lost power.
It's a great example about how that is a double-edged sword. And that's exactly what you're talking about. You become so angry, yeah, that you sort of slip over it. And part of when we ask that question about what do you feel like when you're in conflict, sometimes what we get is people saying, I am struggling not to get emotional. Because we've really worked our whole lives. You know, what is the experience of childhood is that when you're born, when you want something, you cry to get it. And as you grow older, you're able to use words. In fact, we tell our children, use words. Okay? You see how it works? And so the expression of emotion, while it's some emotion is okay, we tend not to cry because that it sort of shows. It's like, in some ways, a sign of weakness. Yeah, or at least we think it might be perceived as weakness. Yeah?
I was going to elaborate on Lowe's study because they've taken it from rats looking at humans. And when they measure stress hormone levels like cortisol and adrenaline, they find that women do indeed friend and, what is it?
Tend and befriend,
as opposed to fight or flight. Mm-hmm. And that it is much more than just physical stress, but when they do replicating emotional stress, whether it's work stress, home stress, financial stress, health stress, whatever the stress is, when those the stress hormone levels are high,
that is women's response. And it's a huge sociological difference than
yeah. life. And they think it's connected with why women live longer, too. They think that that's part of the connection with why women live longer is because that tends to be, because men tend to exert or exhibit and produce more adrenaline and cortisol when they get into conflict. Okay. So conflict's very connected with our experiences. And this is not to say that, I mean, I don't want to talk about eliminating conflict, because conflict is good.
Yeah. Well, I was just about to say that it seems like we have to come to a core belief that conflict is good, and that how we resolve it can be a growth opportunity. Mm-hmm. And but in my case, and I'll bet many of people here would say this, with my parents, conflict was not good.
Yes.
You did not talk to your parents like that. When I told my mother I hated her, she washed my mouth out with soap. You know.
Yeah.
So conflict is not good. So somewhere along the line, you have to re-educate yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And that isn't, you know, even though we think we're sophisticated, some of those old messages.
That's right. Those old messages are hard to tune out, and there's some great information and research done, the fact that you bring all of your past conflict experiences to your present situations. So if you've struggled with issues of intimacy, those will come out in your conflicts. If you struggled with issues with authority, those will come out in your conflict. That you carry with you kind of a full basket full of identities that, actually I spent some time writing them down this afternoon. If you've struggled with issues of control, you know, being in control, always in control, that when you get into conflict, those issues of control, you're going to bump up against those. If someone is trying to control you and you're a controlling person, you will have conflict with that person because you want control. Issues of security and abandonment tend to play a strong role in our society, because if we've, anyway, early in our lives experienced that, no matter how that exists. And if you're interested in doing some work in this area, go back into your childhood and think about the most significant conflicts in your life. Okay? I'm talking about the real tough ones. Death of a parent, you know, all kinds of trauma, whatever those traumas are. Those conflicts continue to sort of, and I'm not saying that, you know, you would want to do this in a public place, but you might want to start to write down, and they don't even always need to be major traumas. Sometimes they could be just things that affected you significantly. And that's an important thing to do, and it's important work if you're looking at managing your homeostasis, your comfort zone. Go back and look at what those conflicts are. Yeah.
Moving to the solution side, one of the most useful courses I ever took was a course called Disrupting the Disruptor, and it was taught by Bennington from Portland. Yes. And he went on for years and years teaching them. And it's bizarre. What you do is you get in a disruptor space. For instance, there were a lot of applications in teaching. You have to be sort of dramatic to do it. But if you are in the disruptor space, the disruptor cannot occupy that space at the same time because you're already there. For instance, a parent who is having problems with their kid begging in the mall or when they go shopping, the parent got so tired of it that they lay down on the floor of the shopping mall and have a temper tantrum. And the kid never had a temper tantrum again because the parent was in his space.
Okay, so it's almost reversal. It's sort of
yes.
placing yourself in the other person's position. Uh-huh. Not a bad option if it can work for you. I would question about what, I think you probably can do it when you're still in control, but if you come out, if you get flooded, my ability to respond, well, maybe it is pretty good, maybe sometimes I can respond. I tend to become the terrorist, and I know I've used that word a couple times, but I think that we all have the ability to be terrorists when we feel powerless and helpless, and when we are unconscious of our own strength, and when we take on a cause. I mean, and anybody that has this orientation, and I tend to be one of those people, I can pick up Anybody here underdoggers? People who just always can pick up a cause? Whatever the issue is, somehow I get kind of sucked into it if I see an underdog. And for me, it relates right back to my life as a kid in school. Another place I can't work is in schools, because I become the terrorist, because in schools, I was whooped upon by teachers who kept thinking that if I just worked harder, I could learn to spell. They were wrong, okay? And so nowadays, when I get in there with teachers, I gotta watch myself, because pretty quickly, I'm like, now I'm in charge, yeah. You know, and I start to kind of, you know, I start to tweak these, and I move the issues, and because of my own abuse issues, okay? My own school abuse issues. And it's an important thing to recognize. Where are your abuse issues?
Another thing, too, is confrontation or confronting a problem and seeing where the other person is coming from. Now, I have a tendency to ask questions when I'm questioned to clarify things. And to some of the people, they think that I'm being evasive. I'm just trying to be clarified because sometimes I get asked a lot of questions at one time when I need to break them down into their individual things. They're like, let's deal with them one at a time, A, B, C, go right down the list. Because I can't answer a bunch of questions at the same time. I have to take them one step at a time.
So you want to sort of make it, keep it rational and sort of keep it linear. And you can answer questions, but not all at once. Because it throws you, right? Because it throws your competency as a person who's supposed to know the answer.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You see how it works? If we can begin to recognize what the heck is going on and why do we keep getting into the same situations. I'll give you an example. I was in school with Jill, with Michaela this year, and Michaela's friend Serena came and had lunch with us at the adult table. And one of the lunch Nazis came over there. And she's like, to this little girl, you know, about this big, she said, is your mother here? What are you doing at this table? And I'm just like, bitch. I mean, that's my response. And I looked at this lady and I said, she's with me. And the woman said, well, you know, this table's reserved for parents. I said, I'm a parent and she's with me. You see how it is? Instantly, I'm like, no, you're not going to terrorize this child. You know, I'm going to stand up. And immediately, I'm like 4 years old again. And I'm being the defender that I was always looking for in my environment. And so we have to look about it. What kind of places do you engage people in conflict? Because probably it's connected to who you are, okay? Where do you work? What do you do? All of those components connect with this idea of your centeredness, your comfort zone. Make sense? I'm going to talk a little bit about this person and this person. I'm talking about a person with a good, nice, high, peaceful homeostasis, you know, broad and wide. And we run into these people all the time, don't we? It's like a person with a very narrow homeostasis who is always fishing for us, okay? And they're constantly sort of casting out this kind of hook to see if they can sort of pull us in. Do you know what I'm talking about? The person in your workplaces, your environments, who always by, and there's some really easy sort of ways they do this. One of them is constantly being negative about whatever the situation is. And everything really, and you get sort of sucked into it. You know what I'm talking about? You know the kind of person? And the idea is, how do you respond to the person who, by their very nature, really is what you perceive to be unstable or maybe unstable is the best word. I mean, how do you deal with those people? Now, how do you deal with them? Yeah.
Go over their heads.
Go over their heads. Right. Sometimes we just say, do it, right?
Well, like for an example, when you were at the Burger King.
Yeah.
Everybody's got a boss.
Everybody's got a boss.
Right over her head. It's like, I wouldn't have moved.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, you're going to deal with this now. Well, your line's going to back up out here. Mm-hmm. You take your pick. You make your choice.
So, I lost your name.
Jeff.
Jeff. So Jeff's response is sort of like, meets it face on. When someone has, when there's a conflict, he basically goes in right at it and says, well, this isn't moving until we get solved. Okay? That's one way of dealing with it. What are other ways that you deal with people who are always in conflict or are creating conflict in your life? How do you deal with them?
Avoid them.
We avoid them. You know, we write them off. We walk out of their conversations. We do that. Karen's looking at Bob like he does it.
No, I was thinking in churches, you can't avoid them and you can't go over their heads because there aren't any bosses.
God. Jesus. No, I know what you're saying. That's a hard place to be, isn't it?
You know, because the pastor's not the boss, but the people aren't the boss either.
Okay, you're right. You're absolutely right. Let's deal with that issue because it happens in churches. And so often, what we want to do is we want to avoid them. We want to shut them down. We want to put them in their place. We want to go above their heads. We want to do everything. Yes?
Make them see reason.
We want to make them see reason. We want to make them see our way. And here's what vision I'd like to give you today is that what I believe that is what we're doing is we're taking our homeostasis and we're saying, bend over, I got something for you. And we're going to kick them. Okay? Because we want to see people grow in front of our very eyes. We want them to be just like us. We want them to have good values. We want them to be centered. We want them, and we just continue to sort of beat on them. Okay? And here's what I'm going to challenge all of you, and I challenge myself to do this, and I don't do it perfectly either. But what I'm encouraging you to do is to say, go there and meet them where they're at and listen to their story. And then begin to challenge them at a level of who they are. In other words, engage them where they're at versus rolling our eyes, walking away, forming a coalition against those people, that group, that person. If we enter into that conversation and we go there, then we do a much better job. I'll give you an example. In a church, exit a church I go to, Trinity Lutheran Church in Crookston, you know, a lot of the people who are fighting any kind of change happen to be an older set, a subset of the group. And what I began to do is, and for a while I would just get together with all the people who agreed with me that change was good, okay? At coffee, we'd sit there at, you know, the worship times. And what I started to do is I started to gather with people that aren't like me and listen to what they're saying about church and that environment. And honestly, I don't always agree with them. And sometimes I tell them I don't agree with them, which is why I'm wearing this shirt tonight, which says Jesus is a liberal. I wore this to the congregational meeting because I wanted to engage, and like this is a lightning rod. Okay. So I was sort of pretending to be a person who's got a nice white homeostasis, and I engaged some people who were absolutely offended by my shirt, and we began to talk about it because I'm interested not in changing them, but engaging them in a conversation about what is their vision. So listening to them, because what happens when we get into conflict is that we immediately stop listening to the other person and we immediately focus only on our own set of very narrow interests, whatever it is, change in a church, growth, liturgy, music, where the pastor preaches from. I mean, the issues in churches are where they place flowers can be an issue, right? I mean, it's just amazing how people find, and you know what I found out is that oftentimes it's where people find the Spirit of God, okay? It's where they have some point in time experienced the Holy, and that's what they want to sort of regain and get back. And so what I started to do is to engage people who don't agree with me in it. And it takes some strength. It really does. It takes some strength. It takes, if you believe you have a good homeostasis, it does take some strength to go there. And rather than arguing your point, to listen to what they are. Because in that, empowerment happens. Clarity, clearness of thought happens for that other person. And what I've started to hear is people, as I talk to them, say, well, that's really not that big a deal. That's not that, you know, this issue isn't that big a thing. If only I could get this. You know, they begin to moderate. Because, you know, what happens when we get into a conflict and we don't get heard, what do? We raise our voice and we say it louder. And it's a mirrored image, okay? And that's how conflicts happen and escalate. So I encourage you, if you are experiencing conflict in situations, that you meet them where they're at, rather than trying to overpower them, to be on them, you know, beat them over the head with those issues. That makes sense? That's tough to do, because sometimes we just want to knock heads. It's like being a parent. You know, Michaela and Jillian are fighting. You know, I used to just grab, you know, Michaela would run in and say, oh, Jillian's not letting me on the computer. And I'd go in and I'd say, Jillian, you know, you've been on the computer long enough. And then Jillian would say, but Dad, you know, this and this and this. And she had a whole bunch of reasons. And all of a sudden, I'm in the middle of this conflict. Does that make sense? Guess what I do now? Michaela says, Jillian won't let me on the computer. And I'd say, tell me more about that. And she's like, oh, she's been on the computer for 20 minutes. And I said, well, how can I help you? I want you to make her get off. And I'm like, well, I can't make her get off. How else can I help you? And you know what? My kids don't come to me as much anymore. And they solve their own problems. They solve their own problems. Right, Jillian? They do. In fact, they know what I'm going to say. Because I've stopped sort of getting in the middle of those kind of conflicts. And I think oftentimes that's what we do. We run in and we think we have the answer. Are we just about out of time? We're just about out of time, or we should be out of time. Any questions about what I've been talking about or comments? Does it make sense? What? Go ahead.
There are some people, though, I mean, you know, in churches that... I mean, some of the books like Antagonists in the Church and Clergy Killers and those kinds of books, I mean, that they have studied. There are people at that very edge where it's no longer helpful to try to engage them and figure out, because they're just out to get you no matter what. And at that point, I mean, what the advice is there is that you just, you know, you know who you are, you state that as clearly as possible. This is where I'm coming from, this is where I need to come from, mm-hmm. And, you know, because they're going to keep playing you. They're going to keep playing you, and just trying to make your life miserable. I mean, and there are, there's not very many people, but there are some of those people.
Yeah, you know, and that the comment that Karen had, it's a very real comment, and to us it's like it's the psychopaths and the sociopaths that we have in our midst, the 2%, 1% of the population that are those sort of personalities. And yes, I think in that situation, what is really weird is as long as I've done conflict resolution and mediation, I've met probably only one or two of them. But you're right, and I think that is, it sort of doesn't fit the 99% norm of people who maintain. Because if a sociopath is a person who doesn't have any sort of values that hold them accountable to the society, and that's what love, caring, trustworthy, all of those things are values that hold you in accordance to the rest of the organization. So, yeah, I think you do have to sort of, at some point, say, okay, I'm going to have to handle this differently. The question becomes for me is, when do I decide people are sociopaths? And I think oftentimes, I call, there's a lot more in the world if I'm not thinking clearly or I'm in conflict. Yes, well, Jeff.
You have to communicate with them to figure out where they're coming from.
Yeah.
And the thing is that the when you, if you stick in the homeostasis point there, you'll learn how to deal with them. You'll learn how to, it's more or less head them off at the pass. It's
right. Like the, absolutely. If you can recognize your triggers and know where you're at in your zone, then you can do it. I taught Michaela and Jillian homeostasis, and one day Michaela was running after Jillian and saying, blah, 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 whatever she was saying. Jillian turns around and says, don't you dare do that, I'm out of my homeostasis. I'm pretty interested now. I said, what do you mean, Jillian? She said, this morning I got up and I got on the bus and Tiffany made fun of my pants. And I got to math class and Mr.
Lundeen
wouldn't tell me how to do the math problem. And she went out and she was able to understand her own triggers. And it's about autonomy, belonging, love, and competency. And she's able to recognize that. And wouldn't it be a good vision if we could actually teach kids to recognize their own homeostasis rather than some sort of linear process that doesn't really work really for anybody. And it's more about how do you recognize what's going on with yourself and then can you stay centered. That's all I have. Thank you very much. Goodbye.